Summer is definitely the sexiest season. I mean, think about it. The days are longer, the nights are hotter, and your sex life is too. And if you're looking to turn up the heat, how about a little help from our friends at Promescent? Summer is all about things hot and steamy, so I highly recommend you add something extra and tap into Promescent's lineup of pleasure-enhancing products. I've been singing their praises for years, since they started, and for good reason. Because first up, we have the legendary Delay Spray. This is the MVP of lasting longer and keeping those eager penile nerves in check. You just do a quick spray, and you're set to outlast even the longest days of summer, ensuring the party doesn't end before you want it to. So you can have the mind-blowing climax you're now so very well equipped to reach, thanks to Promescent. It just helps you last longer without all the worry. And for women, Promescent's warming arousal gel is a fun pre-sex ritual. You just rub it into your vulva a few minutes before and you'll feel it start to tingle, warming up every nerve ending. So you'll feel that much more pleasure everywhere before you even get going. So it's kind of like the sure thing. So make sure this summer is the sexiest one yet. Check out promescent.com/Emily and get 15% off at checkout. You get free shipping, 60-day money-back guarantee, discreet shipping, all the things. Promescent is your ticket to a more guaranteed good time. That's promescent.com/Emily. promescent.com/Emily for your exclusive discount. Check it out.
And I said, so you'd rather avert your eyes than take the tiny risk of saying hello to the person that you made out with last night or had sex with last night, whatever you did last night, and where there might be the possibility then that you could have the relationship that you say you want. And you just went, yeah, that's right.
That's right.
And it's this whole
It's vulnerable, right? It's, they don't want to be vulnerable.
And that's what he said. He said, I did a search at one point of how many times people said vulnerable in this book. And it was so many.
At least they knew the word.
Well, it's really what I think is at the heart. Like even beyond
sex. It's vulnerability. We're all afraid of being hurt, not being loved, right?
And the taboo against it for guys and embracing it and rejecting it and denying it and avoiding it is threaded all the way, all the time through the book. And Brené Brown says that emotional vulnerability is the secret sauce that holds relationships together. If they can't be vulnerable or they feel a taboo against it or they feel denied it as guys, then we are denying them the very thing they need to have the mutually gratifying, personally fulfilling relationships that we want young people to have.
Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and on today's show, I'm joined by writer and journalist Peggy Orenstein to talk about her new book, Boys and Sex, and how we need to change the way we talk to and treat young men. Topics include why young boys and men feel like they are so emotionally stunted, how locker room talk truly affects other people beyond the locker room, why porn is causing an immense issue in developing healthy views on sex, and how parents can be better emotional role models for their sons. All this and more. Thanks for listening.
Look into his eyes. They're the eyes of a man obsessed by sex. Eyes that mock our sacred institutions. Bedroom eyes. Call them in a bygone day.
Hey, Emily, you got a boyfriend?
Because my man E here, he just got his heart broken. He thinks you're kind of cute.
A girl's gotta have her standards. Oh, my.
The women know about shrinkage.
Isn't it common knowledge?
What do you mean, like laundry? It shrinks?
Can we not talk about sex so much?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, my God, that feels so good.
Being bad feels pretty good.
But you know, Emily's not the kind of girl you just play with.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. We're talking about sex, relationships, and everything in between. For more information, check out sexwithemily.com. And all of our information, social media, all the things is Sex with Emily across the board. All right, the intention for this show, I like to call this Intentions with Emily. I start off each show and I ask you to set an intention as well. So what I mean is like while you're listening, you know, why are you listening to this episode? What do you hope to get out of it? I found this to be incredibly powerful to kind of have a statement around something before you start it and then it'll actually happen. So maybe you're thinking, I've never really felt connected to my masculinity and I want to know why. Or it could be, you know, what is all this news about toxic masculinity? I don't like that and I don't want to feel bad about myself or the men in my life. Like, explain it to me. So that's what we're going to talk about in this show. Or my intention for this show is to show what it's really like in society now for boys and men growing up and how we can change the conversation around masculinity and just help us teach better, like, emotional and relationship skills to everyone around us. I'm really excited to welcome my guest, Peggy Orenstein. She's an incredible woman. I've been a fan of her for years. She's a New York Times bestselling author and a journalist. And I found out about her through one of her books, Girls and Sex, which was so fascinating to me. And then I was watching her TED Talk, which you have to check out, What Young Women Believe About Their Own Sexual Pleasure. It's actually been viewed over 4.5 million times. So when I heard she came out with Boys and Sex, I knew I had to get her on the show. She's written other books surrounding women and sex and relationships. If you have women, your daughters, you know, nieces, anything in your life, all these books, the Boys and Sex and the Girls and Sex will be super helpful. She's been a keynote speaker, colleges, big conferences, and she's also featured on so many television shows. So she's gone out there and actually talked to all the people, men, women, boys, and girls, and listened to them, gathered all that information, and put out such important work into the world. It's really information that we need to know. And I really think you're going to enjoy this interview as much as I did. So let me know. Enjoy the show. You wrote a book called Girls and Sex, and yes. I couldn't put it down. You should see my copy. It's like scratched. There's like highlights and there's like pencil marks. And then I sent to people. I think I have the audio. I watched your TED Talk. I have it on my Kindle. I sent it to people. My niece stayed with me this summer. I'm like, read this. I put it by her bed, she's 19 years old. And so when I heard that you wrote Boys and Sex, I was like, she's got to come on the show. This is amazing. So I'm so honored. Thank you for your time and thank you for sitting here with me today. So what was the biggest obstacle for you to like sit down with boys? Like what was the obstacle that you faced sitting down talking with boys about sex rather than girls?
I mean, honestly, I think it was my own bias to be real. You know, I did not, I wrote about girls for 25 years. I wrote about girls and women for 25 years. And boys, people would say, well, you should do a book about boys now after Girls and Sex came out. And I just sort of like, well, I think that's somebody else's job. But I also realized that I'd been in kind of the trenches of young people and sex and social life at that point for like 5 years. And I knew the terrain really well. And so I thought, well, I don't know, maybe I could do it. And I started sort of talking to boys, and then the Me Too movement came along and suddenly the scope of sexual misconduct became apparent and there was a mandate to reduce sexual violence. But it also felt like a moment that was an opportunity to engage boys, maybe for the first time, in these conversations about sex and intimacy and masculinity and gender dynamics. But my big fear and my big bias was that they wouldn't say anything, that, you know, I would have like whole transcripts that consisted of,
right.
Nope.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Right.
Right. That they don't have a reputation for chattiness.
No, exactly.
Like, but so the biggest surprise, I think, of even more than like any specific conclusion in the book, was just how much they wanted to talk, how eager they were to talk, and how really honest and blunt they were.
Because nobody ever asked them. They don't have models of it in their culture with their parents. They're involved in this like the bro culture, which you talk a lot about.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting because when I started hearing about, you know, when Me Too happened, I was like, and everyone's like, oh, men, toxic masculinity. And I just thought, I feel so bad for these young boys.
Right.
And all boys, really, because they're like, we never learned any of this. So I love to hear that when you sat down, they actually did want to open up. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, I know even you opened up the book saying, uh-oh, like this one's not going to open up, and they do. So
yeah.
So maybe a little bit about the bro culture, what that really
yeah.
means.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think the truth is that nobody does ask boys.
No
and they're and nobody's listening to them, and that they are wrestling with these issues now in a new way. And it was a really interesting, I think it was a very opportune moment to do a book like this, because I don't know. I mean, one of the things that was really interesting with the boys was how they were wrestling with ideas that I think maybe 5 or 10 years ago they wouldn't have even been considering.
Well, that's the thing, timing, right?
And so being able to catch them as a new generation was considering these ideas. And yeah, the whole toxic masculinity thing, somebody wrote to me the other day and said, why do you always put it in quotes? And I said, well, because I don't really like to use that phrase. I don't think when you're talking to boys that it serves us very well in trying to help bring them in and help them understand and help them to examine themselves and go forward in the best way they can. So I started using, sociologists use this term, precarious masculinity. And I think that's a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's still evocative of what gets triggered for guys in certain situations that makes them act in ways that are not advantaging them or their partners. But it's kind of less hostile.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's also hostile. So it's like, they're like, well, that's really scary. I don't, you know, when they're starting to hear about it, I don't want to be that guy, but now what do I do? And you're
and
right.
And it also disconnects. I mean, you don't think you're after that guy. So the sort of Holbrook, I mean, one of the things that I think was, when I was looking at girls, like I said, there was, you know, for the thing that always interested me was sort of the contradictions people live with. So with girls, it was sort of about all these new expectations that we had of girls about standing out, about shining bright, while also still hanging on to these old assumptions that we hadn't really dispensed with of being pleasing, defining yourself through your body, you know, all these other ideas, defining yourself from the outside in. And with guys, too, so it probably shouldn't be a surprise that they're now living with contradictions and these new ideas and old ideas layered on top of each
right.
other. And that was kind of what interested me to examine. So, you know, they saw themselves as progressive. A lot of them, they thought, you know, girls were deserving of their place in the classroom. They weren't saying like, girls can't do math, you
right,
know, girls
right.
can't be president. That was all gone.
That was gone.
They thought girls could be leaders. Girls could be, you know, we're deserving of professional opportunities, all that. But yet when I would ask them like, what's the ideal guy? They would still start channeling 1955.
Right.
And it would still be about dominance, aggression, athleticism, wealth, sexual conquest, and, you know, the body count being the kind of measure of the man and using partners as disposable, regardless of how you feel about that, regardless of how they feel about that, and emotional suppression. And, you know, all those things that they call it, you know, the man box or whatever you want to call it, that simultaneously disconnect. I mean, boys would talk to me all the time about training themselves not to feel or putting a wall up. And the only thing they were allowed were happiness and anger, that kind of thing. And we know that that there can be real rewards of embodying or embracing those rigid norms, right? It turns out you can be president.
Yeah.
By embracing those norms,
well, exactly.
right? Right?
Yes.
So there are models that show boys that you can be very successful with that, but it comes at a huge cost. And we know that guys who cling more to those norms are, yes, they're more likely to harass, assault, bully, but they're also more likely to be the victims of violence. They're more likely to be in car accidents, to binge drink, to be depressed, to die by suicide, to have fewer friends, to be lonely. I mean, it's not a pretty picture.
No.
It's really not a pretty picture.
And they opened up for you. So when you sat down with these guys, because the thing is, you're right, even 5 years ago before all the Harvey Weinstein and all the, I mean, I love you even your opening, you list like Aziz Ansari and all the things that happened. It's like, right now, they kind of have to look at it, but nobody is giving them this new information. So no one's saying, but this is how you do it better or differently, or even explain to them what it is, because their parents don't even get it. So here you are sitting, you sat down with how many?
100. Roughly 100.
I mean, that's a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
And then to feel like, and you're just asking them, but for the, I'm going to get, for the first time, they probably ever talked about these things.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff that they had, you know, a lot of conversations started with, I've never talked to anybody about this before, or saying at the end that, you know, it was cathartic or it was therapy or
it feels like,
you know,
it.
Some boys who would say, so when are we going to have another interview? And, you know, some of them
I
would interview repeated.
I love it, but it also hurts my heart.
I know.
Like, where do they go now? Because, you know what I mean? Like, in the sense of, I love that they're opened up. I have this thing too, because like after everyone was so angry about all the men, when all this happened, I was like, well, how do we help them? So
right.
It seems like this was a great point to like talk to them. But when you're talking about, I'm going to go back to them shutting down emotionally, because I think that's so interesting. It's about, you say like it's about age 5 or 6, something happens. It could be even younger,
mm-hmm.
like even pre-memory, but they're like, you have to repress these emotions. You can't, it's not okay to feel. And then some of them in talking to you, they're like, in explaining it, and I could kind of relate to that too, as being someone who was really shut down by things in childhood. It wasn't comfortable to feel. And I think a lot of people can, mm-hmm. men and women can relate to that, but it's definitely more men. Can you explain the repetition of them saying like, yeah, what that experience was for them at those ages? They kind of explained to you the shutting down. They kind of remembered it.
Yeah. They would talk about building a wall. They would talk about being trained not to feel. They'd talk about a lot of messages from their fathers. And what was interesting about that was that, you know, yeah, there were some guys who said, my dad told me to man up, not be a little bitch, you know, that kind of thing. But that wasn't most of them. For most of them, they would say, My dad wasn't sexist. My dad wasn't homophobic. I didn't learn that, you know, they use the phrase toxic. They all knew that phrase,
right.
Toxic masculinity from him. But I did learn the stunted side of masculinity because he was not a guy who'd talk about emotions. He was more of a sigh and walk away kind of a guy than the kind of guy who'd asked you what was going on. And so I learned not to have those conversations from him. So there was the subtler ways that they would learn that too, and not just from their dads. You know, there's research when you say pre-memory, there's research that shows that mothers speak with less emotional range and use less emotional language with their infant boys than with their infant girls. And they over-attribute their boys' responses as in infants to anger. And there's a classic study that shows adults watch a video of an infant being startled by a jack-in-the-box. Mm-hmm. And if they're told in advance that the baby is a boy, whether or not that's true, baby's wearing a diaper, we don't know what the baby is, they are more likely to attribute the baby's response to the jack-in-the-box as anger as opposed to fear or surprise or anything else. And so there's a way that from the beginning – boys, first of all, live in a more impoverished emotional environment and also learn that all of those, that whole bucket of emotions that involves sadness, grief, pain, betrayal, frustration, you know, all gets poured into the funnel of anger. And we can see in the culture, you know, the impact of that across the board.
Yeah. I mean, because there's also like anger, and to experience the range of 5 or 6 emotions, anger and sadness and fear. What is it? Enjoy and happiness. And mostly, yeah, it's just like, I could see that. It's anger.
Yeah.
And there's such a range. So what can parents do now? Did anything, how can they talk to their kids about masculinity?
Well, I think there's a number of things. There's always something in the news we can talk about. You know, there's always something that we can bring up. If you have little boys still, to be able to name their emotions is super important.
Mm-hmm.
So to say, you know, it seems like you're sad. Or, wow, that must be frustrating. Or when they are going straight to anger, taking a step back and trying to figure out what's underneath that anger so you can name that for them. And particularly if men in their lives can do that, whether it's their dad or, you know, whoever the man in their life is, to be able to speak with compassion and connection to boys and listen to them and model that as a guy, hugely important.
Yeah.
And for older boys, like I was thinking about the other day, like the Kobe Bryant's death, super tragic. Really, you know, a horrible thing. And we saw this, I mean, there was a bunch of things that you could talk about relating to that. One of them is the outpouring of grief by adult men and what that looked like and how profound it was. And why is it that the only time that men get to express that is when something this tragic
right.
And public happens,
and
then
sports.
It's okay.
So it's safe.
And it's
sports. Because you talk a lot about sports in your book and athleticism and how,
And so that was
safe.
There was a lot that was made it safe for them to express emotion around that. So if you're just talking to your teenage boy about that, you know, they can have a conversation around like, why is that safe? Why is that okay? What other situations would you be able to cry? Why not? You know, what does that mean about guys? I mean, there's a whole series of conversations you can have around something like that in the news.
Right. No, that's true. That's such a great example of it because it's so true that they sports made it safe. I hadn't even thought about that, but it's very
true.
And I mean,
there's some more complicated conversations you can have too around the Kobe Bryant death, around assault and around race and around a number of things.
There's it's chock full.
There are so many conversations that yields that are really valuable. And you just have this moment where you can step in and have them. And, you know, very tragic event, obviously, but a fantastic opportunity to do that.
Yeah, that's true. I often say, like, look at things that you bring your kids in. If you're watching TV, stop the TV. I don't know. It's not like people aren't really watching it all with their kids anymore.
Right.
But if you are, or if there's something in the paper or a blog or something you're reading to kind of make it more, you know, relevant. So, you know, so it's like sports is kind of like an outlet to let out their emotion. And it's also like the bro culture and the locker room
talk. It
can
be a smokescreen. I mean, those all male environments can be a crucible of change. And I talk about some ways in the book where they have been, you know, particularly if it's coach led, where those environments can shift in really profound ways. But too often, that sports culture, while it can be fun and it you know, preaches that it builds character and camaraderie and brotherhood and all this stuff, it's also a smokescreen for the worst kind of bro culture and an us against them mentality, homophobia, misogyny, bonding, you know, asserting your heterosexuality and bonding as men through the control of female bodies. So what do they say when they're talking about sex in the locker room, right? They hit that, they tap that, they bang, they pound, they hammer, they pipe that. It's like they went to a construction site, right? It's not
exactly.
Like, you know, it's not an act of intimacy. And so the guys that I was talking to, it's not like they were all like, and that's cool, you know, like
they didn't think it was like,
no. Right? And I think a lot, you know, they a lot of guys don't. They wanted to speak up. They didn't know how to speak up. One guy talks about trying to speak up and being shot down. And then his friend continues to try in, you know, when it happens again and he doesn't. And he said, you know, I just watched my friend and nobody, you know, the guys weren't listening to him anymore. He lost all his social capital. And here I had buckets of it and I wasn't spending it. And, you know, I don't know what to do because I don't want to have to choose between my dignity and these guys. But how do I make it so I don't have to choose? And Michael Thompson, who's a psychologist who writes about boys, has said that it's silence in the face of cruelty and misogyny in which boys become men. And I thought about that a lot in those situations and what boys, not only what they did say and did do, but what they couldn't do and couldn't say and, you know, all of that and how that was shaping who they were.
Did you see in talking to them, would they ask you and say, well, what could I do now? How could I change this? Or was it more like, this is just how it is?
So when I was interviewing them, I would say not so much because it wasn't my role. But as I've gone around with the book, like I just the other day had a Division I athlete come up to me at a reading and say, so what do I do? Like, I want to stop this and what do I do? And I, you know, I sort of said, well, in a signing line at a reading, hard for me to give you the full answer. But he emailed me later and I just, you know, I gave him a bunch of resources, a bunch of ideas about like,
if what you are the work, resources that you think of? I know you know, and people, we're talking about, I'm talking to Peggy Orenstein. Her book is New York Times bestselling author of Girls and Sex. She finally came out with Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity.
Yeah.
It is a must read.
Thank you.
It'll be in the show notes. So yeah, you have all the resources.
Well,
we don't have to.
I mean, I gave him a bunch of ideas in terms of, you know, it depends. It depends on, is your coach somebody who you can approach and talk to about this who might be open to bringing some programming in that would change the culture of the locker room? That would be thing one. Maybe he is, maybe he's not. If he's not, then like, how could you reach out to other people who you feel would be on your team that are on your team? And how could you, you know, what kind of things could you do that would sort of social norm some of this stuff, you know, to change it? What could you, is there, if there's one guy who's really a major perpetrator and you're friendly with him, are there ways to take him aside when it's not a threatening time and just like speak your piece? And he's going to push back and say, what, dude, you know, do I need to get you a tampon?
Right,
or, you
exactly.
know, whatever. And you can say, you can say that, but I'm still going to tell you, this is how I feel. I just wanted to let you know I'm not okay with this. And okay, now let's go back and play our video game or whatever.
Right, you know,
like
exactly.
How you, just like some different options from a more collective option to a more individual option.
Because we're just not teaching these kids even basic communication
skills. Basic communication
skills.
Like,
why are we teaching that in schools?
Yeah.
Or are we
so like if
things?
You start there, you're starting with these basic communication skills that nobody has talked to kids about. Like when you're wondering like how they can't have conversations around consent or why they don't know what positive sexuality is, geez, they can't even get here.
Right. Exactly. They're not even the basics. We can't get there from there.
Yeah.
That's why it's such a big, huge right now, because it's like it's the parents and the teachers and then the kids, and we're all trying to figure it out. And we don't want to raise another generation of this. Were there any interesting, like after spending so much time with girls, 25 years with girls, and now you're like, oh God, now here I am with men. That must have been, and boys, that must have been such an interesting contradiction. But were there contradictions though when you sat down, a contrast? And then when you sat down, was there anything that you kept hearing from boys that was just like, I don't know, that must have been, was there ever a moment where you're like, wow, this makes so much sense to tell my girls
what?
Do you actually hear it?
I think
it?
That actually, I mean, the one place of real overlap in both books is the chapter on hookup culture.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
And they're the same and they're different. And so much of the girl book, and you know, I always say my job is not to tell young people the context in which they're supposed to have sex. That's not my role. But to demystify that, the hookup culture,
yeah,
and to give them a sense of what you are likely and not likely to get from those sorts of encounters, I think is really helpful for them in understanding their choices and the results, and also understanding how it vastly overstates what other people are doing. And gives you false ideas about what's happening.
So give me an example of that, some of the hookup culture stuff that seemed like it was that was sort of the same.
Different. So this, you know, obviously what's the same is that they're both immersed in this culture, and that this hookup culture is telling them that, you know, drunk detached sex is the ideal.
Still, it seems to be so upset. I know. Blackout.
Yeah, right.
It'd be great. You won't remember. Did it.
Yeah. You haven't gone out unless you blacked out.
Yeah.
That was something they would really say.
I still think about that from your girl's book, how you kept saying like, because then I started seeing it everywhere about how these girls, yeah, they're all just blacked out. And again, having nieces at that age, it was just like listening to them saying, like, yeah, I was wasted. I'm like,
and how good can the sex be in that situation? And what was the same too was that while girls had a lot more anger and betrayal around hookup culture tends to teach kids what they don't want. That right. tends to be the big lesson of hookup culture. Mm-hmm. But the girls would express a lot of anger and a lot of betrayal. And some of them were telling me that they were into it too, but you know, when it was going wrong for them, the boys didn't express that so much, but it was really clear that it wasn't serving them either.
Okay.
They would say things like, one of the guys said, it's like two people having two distinct experiences, and there's not a lot of eye contact. There's not a lot of, communication. And it's like you're acting vulnerable without being vulnerable.
Right.
Which, with somebody that you don't know very well and don't care about very much. So he said, you know, I don't know that it's always a problem necessarily, which one could argue about, but he said, it's odd and it's not really fun.
Well, because they don't have anything to compare it to either. Like, this is their first experience of sex.
So it seems like, you know, the valuation is wrong. So they're thinking what you want is experience. And that's what gets you experience. What you want is, you know, as opposed to like wanting to understand your body, wanting to greater humanity in your partner, wanting to have something reciprocal and enjoyable and, you know, that collaborative, you know, none of that.
It's almost like a sports mentality. Like the more runs I do, like if it's skiing, like the more hills I go down, the more people I bang, the more people, then it's really going to help me. Then I'll be a better lover or better
And you're sex. Not, one of the things that I always say is one thing you will not learn in a hookup is the skills you need to, you know, create good sex or the emotional connection you might want.
Right.
That's not going to happen. You will get a warm body, you will get an adrenaline rush, and you'll get a story to tell your friends, which is in some ways the most important part of the hookup.
It is, right?
Right. And so one of the things that I talked about a lot in the girl book was like the irrelevance of female orgasm in a hookup.
Irrelevance. It doesn't even come up. It's not a thing.
No. You know, like it's nice if it were to happen. That would be certainly not a bad thing.
Right.
But nobody's expecting it.
No.
It's not what it's. That's not what you're there for. That's not what it does.
No.
And so I was interested in talking to guys about that. And it turned out that, they would say in a hookup, I mean, in a relationship, the orgasm gap shrinks a lot.
Yes.
But in a hookup, it's huge. And guys would say, yeah, I know it sounds bad, but I don't really care in a hookup. And
do they even know about orgasm, though? Do they know about the clitoris? Do you feel like they were educated?
No. Mm-hmm. No, they know female women have orgasms, not really. And they know, like, conceptually an idea that there's a thing called a clitoris, but how the whole situation
works and might happen,
they're not so clear. And there's a lot of misunderstanding. And one of the misunderstandings, and this was not really about orgasm, it was about satisfaction, was that. And this was where it felt really interesting to have the books kind of in conversation with one another. The guys did care about female satisfaction. They just didn't define it through orgasm. So how they defined it in a hookup was because, again, it's about the invisible audience in the room, right? It's about what you're going to go back and tell your guys, what she's going to go back and tell her girls. So how they were measuring female satisfaction was based on penis size and stamina, mostly stamina. In intercourse.
Like
how long you last.
We went for 2 hours and she thought my penis was massive.
Well, success. No, but it's also what she's going to tell her friends, not what you're going to tell your friends.
Right.
So one guy would say to me like that he had gotten the habit in a hookup of looking at the clock before he started intercourse so that he would last what he can, you know, believe to be a sufficient amount of time because he said, it wasn't really even about her pleasure. It was about my ego and making sure that when she went back to her friends, she wouldn't say she was disappointed and that she would, you know, say that I was okay.
It's almost like a Yelp review, because your Yelp review for sex, because the boys you talked to were, let's say the ages again, it was like
16 to 22.
Right.
So the girls then are colluding in that because they're going back and saying, yeah, it was great. He, you know, he had a big dick, or it was great. He lasted for 10 minutes, but then they're not saying, and by the way, you know, I didn't have an orgasm and that's not what gets me off, you know?
Exactly.
Or they were faking.
Yeah, they fake all the time.
And that's the other thing, was that guys vastly overestimate girls' orgasms and hookups. So they do think the girls are having orgasms, and that's sometimes because they don't know what that is, and it's sometimes because the girls are faking.
Yeah.
So there's like a whole like dynamic that's at play that undermines any communication and undermines, you know, mutual satisfaction and undermines connection. So the other part in terms of connection is that after a hookup, you're supposed to be less friendly than before. So although what hookup culture means, and why, I mean, obviously casual sex has always existed.
Casual sex, hookup, yeah.
But hookup culture is the idea that sex, that casual sex is the normalized path to a relationship, even though most hookups don't lead to a relationship. And that's partly because you're supposed to be less friendly afterwards. So guys would talk about like averting their eyes if they saw a girl that they'd hooked up with. And I would go like, well, why would you do that? And he said, well, you know, the guy that I was talking to said, well, you know, you don't know what they're thinking. And maybe they're thinking it was just something that happened at a party. And then you're the idiot if you say, you know, hi, you know, like if you're like, think it was some, like they think that then you think it was something more, and you don't want to be in that position. So you just avert your eyes to avoid the whole thing.
Right.
And I said, so you'd rather avert your eyes than take the tiny risk of saying hello to the person that you made out with last night, or had sex with last night, or whatever you did last night. And where there might be the possibility then that you could have the relationship that you say you want. And you just went, yeah, that's right.
That's right.
That's right. And it's this whole like,
it's vulnerable, right? It's, they don't want to be vulnerable.
Yes. And that's what he said. He said, you don't want, and that's why I said, again, like I did a search at one point of how many times people said vulnerable in this book. And it was so many, like
at least they knew the word.
Well, it's really what I think is at the heart, like even beyond
Absolutely.
Sex.
Absolutely. It's vulnerability. We're all afraid of being hurt, not being loved, right?
And the taboo against it for guys, and embracing it and rejecting it and denying it and avoiding it is threaded all the way, all the time through the book. And, you know, Brené Brown says that emotional vulnerability is the secret sauce that holds relationships together. So if they can't be vulnerable, or they feel a taboo against it, or they feel denied it as guys, then we are denying them the very thing they need to have the mutually gratifying, personally fulfilling relationships that we want young people to have.
Right. So essentially we're saying they're never going to get there unless they learn to experience this range of emotions and learning to be vulnerable in all
and
areas
be brave
of their life.
And have the true courage, the true courage, which is the courage to like see the other person and try to connect with them, you know? So it's.
And we're not setting them up for that in colleges. Was there any surprises though? Was there anyone who was like, they were in a healthy relationship?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are some cases.
For
of
sure.
That,
or guys who were coming out the other side of that culture, a little bit older, and were thinking about things in a different way. There's one guy that I talk about. It's actually there's this great scene in that hookup chapter that this guy who he calls himself a feminist fuckboy, which I loved. Some people call that guy a soft boy or something like that. But he was somebody who, you know, he talked a good game of being an egalitarian guy. He was very conscious of consent. But he also treated his partners as disposable. And he also used the skewed ratio of girls to guys on campus that advantaged guys and allowed them to call the shots in what was going to happen. You know, he used that, and he knew he was using that to get, you know, sleep with as many girls as he could. And when I met him, he was getting to a point where he was saying that he was starting to think about that and think that maybe that was not serving him so well. And so he was thinking about that. And then I talked to him about a year later, and we were talking about where he was at. And while we were talking, this other boy who was a senior in high school and was looking at colleges, where he'd been accepted, deciding where he was going to go, texted me from one of the campuses. And he said, you know, something like WTF with hookup culture. It's like an orgy down here. Do I just go to Bone Town and, you know, forget about emotions? I mean, they, in case you were wondering how they spoke to me.
No, I get it. No, perfect. That's how they,
right. And he was like, and worry about emotional connection later, or do I just forget about that in part entirely? And so I read that text to the feminist fuckboy guy, his name was Wyatt, and said, what do you have to say to Nate? What should I tell him? And they ended up having this conversation through me.
Oh, wow.
And talking about, like, you know, being your authentic self and how if you try to be somebody you're not, it's going to kill you. And there's lots of people who have a different idea on campus about what they want. They don't participate in that. You don't have to. And Nate then, you know, texted me back and said, that's just what I needed to hear. Oh. Thank you. And little heart emoji. And
I love it.
And I know, because he's somebody that I stay in touch with, that that conversation supported him in being the guy he wanted to be as he went away to college when he finally chose where he was going to go. And that he is the guy he wants to be. He's been able to maintain his integrity in that way and his personal ideals. And I thought, you know, those guys are strangers to one another. They never met. They don't know each other's real names. And they barely know me,
right.
You know, I'm really a stranger. But what if they could talk like that to boys and men in their real lives? What if they could have those kind of connected, deep conversations?
I know, I was just trying to think of, like, could there be some kind of chat, Facebook group? I mean, maybe this exists, and there are more masculinity, all these things coming out.
Or even, like, in another scene in that chapter, I sit down with a group of guys and girls together, and it's after the day after the party, the day after the night before, and we have a conversation about all of this. And they were so into it, and they were so amazed by what the other sex said. And then at the end, we talked for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, and I got up to leave, and they said, can we do this again next week? And I was like, yes, but not with me, because I'm an adult and don't live in the dorm.
Exactly. But it's like a little group therapy. But just the taste of it.
Just
men's
the
group
idea.
Group.
They were like, wow, we had no idea. And it was, but that was like a co-ed group too. And that, that was really interesting.
That is amazing.
It was the only time I'd sat down with a co-ed group, and they were like, we want to do this again.
And
we want to know
more.
And
they were in college?
They were 18, 19. They were freshmen in college. Yeah.
That's what they need. It has to be required in campuses right now. There's a lot of work to do here.
Yeah.
Because it's really, the hookup culture thing has been going on now since, when did they first coin that? Like early 2000s? Or was it late 90s?
Yeah.
It just seems like, I remember one year there was like 5 books that came out on the hookup culture. And it was just like, is that still happening? And we just see, you know, it's just so not satisfying.
Yeah, it's entrenched. It's absolutely. And I think my favorite book on it is American Hookup by Lisa Wade. I just think it's so smart.
It is. Yeah. I mean, that is one of them. It's true. And I think setting it up before they get into college. Yeah. How do we do that? Like in orientation? I know.
Well,
like,
but it needs to go well before college, because now what has happened, what I think has changed is that culture has drifted downward. So that it's now really prevalent on high school campuses as well. And they don't, when they talk about a hookup in high school, they're usually not talking about intercourse,
right?
But they're still talking about a kind of detached experience, whatever is in that experience, a disconnected, detached experience that is often typically happens while wasted. Yes, I think that, you know, we need to be having those. I mean,
what age though? Don't you think though it has to start with like consent? I agree.
We
like,
need to be talking
your penis,
about kids
your
scrotum, from
here's your clitoris, here, like anatomy.
Here's your vulva. Yeah.
That's what I think it starts with anatomy and then consent. Yeah. Don't let anyone touch you. Like, you know, it's private.
And you need to ask before you hug somebody and not letting, like,
do you
if
think
you
all of that. Is that
yeah,
what they
and
do
like
in Berkeley?
If your kid, you know, if Great Aunt Nancy comes over and wants to put a big smooch on your kid, and your kid, your 4-year-old goes, I don't want to kiss Great Aunt Nancy. Well, Great Aunt Nancy's just got to suck it up. You don't get to kiss, because that is a consent issue. That is bodily integrity. You know, those are really important lessons. It's not just what you don't do. It's what cannot, you know, what you are, what people don't do, even people in your life, even people you love, even your friends, you know, just saying, can I give you a hug? It's not that big of a deal.
It's not that big of a deal. And in fact, it's like,
and it really
it feels so much
scaffolds.
Better.
It scaffolds into those more difficult. If you're coming in at 16, you can do it for sure.
Right.
But, and you can say like, there's a lot of conversations we didn't have and I regret that. And now we're going to have them. It's harder. It's a lot easier if you've been talking about these issues openly since your child was able to speak.
Exactly. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back more with Peggy Orenstein. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's a kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. Also, like with porn now too, with all the boys. I mean, that's a thing. I get texts too from like friends' sons, friends' daughters. Like, what do I do? You know, and it's just like, it is the whole, they don't want to talk to their parents about it. But if you start young, then it's just the most normal thing
and
in the world.
And it's easier. And also having, I mean, lucky your friends' kids that they have you. But there's, you can have the cool aunt or the, cool, you know, or the cool uncle or the, you know, the older cousin or even the older sibling that steps in and takes, you know, and does some of that. That's fine. But yeah, the porn conversation. I mean, that's one of the reasons.
Talk about porn. But, I mean, because that's why we got to start early, because they're seeing it at 9, right. And 10, 11.
Well, I just was talking to somebody whose daughter at 12 got busted for she and some other girls were sending really degrading and violent hardcore images to one another on text and to people who did not ask to have those sent to them. So there were legal issues, there were consent issues. But more than that, I was talking about it with my daughter, who's 16. And I said, and this was an opportunity for me to have a conversation with her. I was just saying, it's such a bummer. Like you're 12 years old and that's what you're seeing about
sex. They were saying
like
naked photos to
not just naked, but like really graphic and violent.
Right. Okay.
And that's the thing that we have to realize. Yeah. It's not like they're sending Playboy centerfolds to each other. Right. If you don't know what today's porn looks like, you need to look at it because what has changed? I mean, obviously,
like bondage, just like that kind of,
or like, you know, a woman with being gagged by a penis with mascara running down with her tears.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Okay. I mean, you're seeing that when you're a 12-year-old girl.
Mm.
That
so
sucks.
I know.
That's so disturbing.
That sucks.
Yeah, it
does.
Sucks.
You're
it's just like. Now you can't unsee that.
You can't.
Now that's in your head. I mean, it's just sad. Yeah. It always reminds me of one of the guys who said to me, I mean, the whole porn conversation, and we'll have that in a second, but one guy just kind of, and this was a guy who was pretty like into hookup scene and into all this stuff. And he just went, but you know, I feel like the thing with porn is that it's made it for our generation, like just the natural process of discovering sex without preconceived notions of what it is. He said, that's just been fucked for us by porn.
There's no
and that
surprise.
Was like the saddest thing to me of all, like that you just don't get to find it out without these prepackaged ideas being fed into your head. That's just sad.
That is really sad because you can't unsee any of it. So of course you think that that's what sex is going to be.
Or it affects you. It absolutely affects you. So all saying all that, I always want to say, and I know that you know this, that curiosity about sex is normal. Masturbation, yay. Everybody should be doing it, you know, as much as possible. What's different is that, and you know, we could debate for adults, whether there's such a thing as ethical porn or feminist porn or queer porn or all these other kinds of things. Some people say yes, some people say no, whatever. That's all behind a paywall. That's not what kids are looking at. We're talking about is that the paywall got dropped by Pornhub in 2007, basically. And so that allowed you to get access to anything anonymously for free.
It was 2007.
At any time on your smartphone. And that's what changed. And so young people, when we're not having, and that version of porn shows kids over and over, sex is something that men do to women, that female pleasure is a performance and really like wildly distorted.
Not accurate. She's not going to show up with three friends.
Nope, she's not.
Squirt.
And start just screaming the second you, it just doesn't work that way. Right. You know, it doesn't work that way, right? And that's what they see. And when we're not talking to them, when they're not getting anything in school, when there's nothing countering that narrative about what, you know, what sex actually is, what's real, what's not real, what's missing, you know, sensuality, playfulness, messiness, you know, passion,
right.
All these things.
Passion, romance, intimacy.
Any of it.
Intimacy.
When we're not talking about any of that with them, this is their sex educator.
Right.
This is
it's either
what
you or you porn.
Right.
Right.
It's you or you. Thank you very much. It's you or you porn. Mm-hmm. That's a very good line.
Thanks. You
and
can use that.
Thank you.
I've used your lines all the time.
But it's true. And that's what they take into the bedroom. And the boys respond. It was one of the things they most wanted to talk about, actually.
Oh, yeah. Tell me. So is it as bad as I think? Like, are they really saying, like, do they know it's not real? You said
yeah,
that they do.
Well, they do and they don't.
Because like, they don't know what, they're like, oh, I hear what you're saying, but I don't know
and
what
they
else
would say,
it.
I mean, they responded in a lot of different ways. Some guys had said, I'm kind of done with this because I don't like what it's doing to my fantasy life. I don't know what it's doing to my mind.
How old were the boys that said that they were done with it?
Well, one of them was a senior in high school.
Okay.
And he said what did it for him was that he was sitting in class one day. And he looked over at the girl next to him, and he started wondering what she would look like with cum on her face.
Oh my God!
And he said it wasn't even like he was thinking, what would it be like to kiss her? What would it be like to see her naked? Nothing. It was like, what would she look like with cum on her face? And he just went, oh shit! And like he said, that's it. I got to stop this.
Wow!
And so that was like a kind of deep thing.
Like I wish he would like go to his friends that day,
right?
You know, from work, you know.
Well,
what?
And they would say like there were guys. You know, one guy said to me that there was a guy on his crew team who was legendary because he had stopped using porn. And they said, "Well, what do you do?" And he said, "I use my imagination."
Right.
And the other guys were just like, how do you do that? Like it wasn't even
true.
A thing.
Right.
If you grew up after 2007 with Pornhub, it wasn't even really a thing. So, you know, part of it was like, you're not going to get rid of the porn, but like, can we broaden their idea
Let's
of
just,
what you
exactly.
might,
exactly? Can we?
How
you might
approach masturbation that might not only be more pleasure. I mean, and distinguishing between what's super arousing and what's actually pleasurable and wanted and desirable. That was one thing I talked a lot about.
Like,
what that means.
Yeah. Let's talk
well,
about that.
Like, so I looked at, do you know Emily Nagoski's work?
Yes.
So she's fantastic, right? The book mm-hmm. Come As You Are is like a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about genital nonconcordance, which is that you can be aroused by something that the body will do what the body will do. So if the body thinks that something sexual is afoot, it will react, it will lubricate, it will get an erection, even if you're thinking, ick, right? Because and that's why a woman can orgasm during a rape. Or, you know, you can get an erection from something that you find repugnant. And in fact, what Emily will say is that there's a way that when you find something both objectionable and sexual, that it actually will turbocharge arousal.
Because you're getting all the dopamine, all
Yeah, because there's
right?
like all this
spiking.
Stuff going on in mm-hmm. your brain and make
Makes
it actually
so much sense.
More arousing than something that's desirable. And I think that, you know, sometimes guys would talk about seeing stuff that was like stuff that you would never even think of,
right.
you know, like really off the charts. And it would be arousing to them and they would be disturbed by the fact that it was arousing to them. And so I think understanding some basic aspects of physiology and
right.
genital nonconcordance and that whole thing is really important when you're going into a porn world. So you can kind of say, oh, there's a reason why I feel like I'm not into this, but my body's going, yeah, 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 yeah. I can understand that better and maybe respond to it differently.
So what happens though now is though, we talk about the genital nonconcordance, is that they're actually seeing it. And maybe it's something like, maybe the first time they do see a gangbanger choking
right.
and or
and they think ick, but then
go,
it becomes.
And then the next
yeah.
time and the next time,
right.
they skip right over it. It could happen
right.
in a matter of seconds or a few times. So what we're saying is to even identify that moment in time, hopefully before it happens,
yeah. and is useful.
Because they also
It's not a shaming, blaming thing. It's just saying, like, look, hey, this is how this works.
So interesting.
How do you think about this? And then there was a whole another set of guys, of course, who said, and there was a small subset of guys who felt really deeply harmed. And I can't say whether it was a chicken and the egg thing, you know, in terms of their porn use, but I can say that they never talked to an adult before about it and that they were struggling and they wanted to talk to somebody about it. And then there
about
was
a, which part of it, the part that they about felt
that they felt
or
harmed.
Self-loathing
they
after,
felt, or like, they felt that it had skewed their ideas of sex. Mm. They felt they were being aroused by things they didn't want to be aroused by. Mm. They felt that it had taught them negative lessons. They felt that it shaped that it. I mean, there's some research that shows that guys who are regular porn users are more likely to believe those images are true, more likely to want to act them out in the bedroom, and they're more likely to, they're less satisfied with their partnered experiences, with their own performance, with their partner's bodies. And so it was some of that kind of thing, like a boy who said that he said, I don't know if it's totally porn driven, but I think it certainly made a difference that I watched all this porn, that I've developed a very, very specific idea of a female body that turns me on. And so when I'm with my girlfriend and she doesn't, you know, she's saying she doesn't feel good about her body in some way. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm saying to her, no, I love your body. But I said privately, I'm thinking, but I wish your nipples were a little darker and a little larger, because that's really what I get off on when I'm looking at the porn stuff. And he said, it just doesn't feel good to me.
Right. And he doesn't know how to undo it because that's all he's really.
And he doesn't know, like, who knows if that's driven by porn or not. I can't say.
It must be, though, but, right? I mean, how else would he have had these images
of
different nipples?
That's what he says. That's what he says. And so, you know, that kind of thing, he was just pondering that. Like, I don't know what kind of impact this had on me. I think I feel harmed by it. I can't say whether that's what harmed him, you know, that is the reason for that or not. But I can say he wasn't talking to anybody about it. That no, there was no adult that he could ask any questions about that. And then the other bunch of boys were guys who would say, like, I know it's not real. I know the difference between fantasy and reality. And I would think, really? Because you've never actually, like, kissed a girl?
Right. How would you know? Never seen anyone naked?
You've never seen anybody
right.
naked?
How would you do it? Right.
And we know the research that that's not true, that the way media works, porn or we haven't, I mean, mainstream media, it's really easy to get right. down the rabbit hole of the porn conversation. Right. Mainstream media is a big issue too, obviously.
Yes.
How media works is that it affects our thoughts, feelings, and beliefs and behavior, even when we think it doesn't. And especially when we think it doesn't, which is why the Russians used media to undermine our democracy.
Exactly.
Because it works. It does. That's why advertising is effective.
God, it's
you know?
So true.
So even when you're saying, I know that's not real, I know that the media doesn't affect me, it affects other people, whether it's porn, whether it's mainstream media, whatever it is, that's not true.
No. Because that's not true. Intellectual, but it's affecting your neural pathways, your brain, what's
right.
arousing to you. You can't.
And you see things like with mainstream media, I talk about a study. I'm sorry, I love talking about this stuff. I know there's a lot of other stuff to talk about. But
no,
we've
got this.
But
is
like
amazing.
There's a study that out of University of Massachusetts where they showed college guys, they divided them into two groups, right? And they showed one group like whatever, cartoons or something. And the other group, they showed an edited together reel of sex scenes from R-rated movies,
okay.
not X-rated, not porn. And they said, and they were all scenes that had been judged to include things that were degrading to women. And, but they were not violent. So
okay.
it was like male satisfaction, but not female satisfaction, or, some kind of stripping thing that was where there was male domination mm-hmm. and female, you know, submission, those sorts of
right.
things. And when afterwards they had the guys read, all of them read one account of stranger rape and one account of acquaintance rape.
Okay.
And they reacted the same way to the stranger rape. That was wrong. But the acquaintance rape, the guys who just watched the reel of the R-rated movie stuff were much more likely to say that the woman secretly wanted what happened and got what she deserved and enjoyed it. And that held steady regardless of their attitudes towards sex, regardless of their attitudes towards porn,
wow.
regardless of their attitudes towards gender and feminism. It affected them immediately.
Mm.
And they call it a spillover effect of media. So there's a spillover effect of this stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, how do they even... So if there is this spillover, I mean, of course, if that's all they're seeing, okay, so going back to the porn, if that's all they're seeing, and then also you talk to women about porn, I mean, your book was like, it was the same thing, that porn was still around when you did your book.
Right, not, yes, it was. And
so,
but the girls tended to look at it as a manual for right. what guys wanted.
They're and, like, so they're making the noises and yeah, they're moving
and the
in the
body,
certain ways.
And like feeling a lot of body inadequacy. And the boys felt a lot of body inadequacy around it too. But the girls felt, I think, even more.
So what are the boys saying that they like? Because the example of saying like, I like your nipples this way, like there's a lot more of that I know in the book too about what boys are actually finding attractive now they might not have before. And it's scenarios like, I know the choking thing comes a lot. I get a lot of callers.
Yeah, the
and
choking.
Who are
so
like,
that's obviously that is straight out of porn.
Straight out of porn. Because no one was asking me that 15 years ago.
Yeah. And that is a really huge change in American sexual behavior that has shot up. Anal sex has shot up.
Anal squirting.
Yeah, that was not a thing.
No. None of these things were things. And now they're all things every day. They're
yeah.
things now.
So those
that don't feel good and behavior. That women think they have to do it. Maybe it feels
yeah.
good, but like you don't
yeah,
have to do
maybe
it.
Maybe it does. Maybe it, but it's looking at the, you know, what I was always looking at was like the motivation and the experience and the nature of the experience. So like when you look at anal sex, there was a survey of kids 16 to 18 in England, about anal sex. And what came out of it was that it was something that, the guys were doing not as an act of intimacy with a partner, but as a competition with other guys. They thought that girls would have to be coerced into it and that they could be coerced into it. Mm. The girls reported finding it painful, not surprisingly.
Yeah.
And both sexes, this was the kind of interesting part, blamed that on the girls, saying that they couldn't relax, they were naive, they were flawed. You know,
well, women were so easy. We always take the responsibility. We do blame ourselves, but especially with anal, I could see that. I mean,
yeah. But we're talking about high school students. So the rates among high school students are still quite low, but they're much higher than they were.
Right.
And I didn't
even
college
know about
students.
It. No one even brought up anal,
I know.
Like, right?
And college students, I mean, the rates among college students are significantly higher than they used to be. And again, maybe that's fine. Maybe that's about experimentation. Maybe that's about pleasure. If that's true, that's fine. But we know that when, on the largest survey of American sexual behavior, when anal sex is included, that 70% of women report pain in their sexual encounters.
Because they're not doing it
and
right.
They're not doing it right. They don't know. Because again, we don't educate around that. Whether we're talking about two people with penises having anal sex or anal play, or people with a penis and people with a vagina. Okay. We don't discuss, or a vulva, we don't discuss the correct way that would make that a pleasurable experience. That's super taboo in sex. And that's one of the, I don't know, have you watched the movie Sex Education?
Yes. Oh yeah.
I mean, not the
I'm
movie,
obsessed.
The
yes.
Netflix show.
I'm on
Excuse
like,
me.
Yes, I'm on season 2, episode 3.
So in season 2, I don't know if you've gotten yeah. to the part yet, but they end up having a whole conversation about preparation for anal sex.
I heard it was done well. I haven't
about,
seen it yet though.
It's
yeah.
very good. It's very good. And it really shows a way to do that that is perfectly appropriate.
Right. That's, yeah. I mean, I was going to ask
Which
you.
Which is not
I've seen it, like,
encouraging.
You slow down,
it's
breathe,
not,
use lube. We talk about it on the show
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, and it's not about, like, encouraging a behavior or, you know, saying, hey, go do this or anything. But it's about, you know, understanding human sexual behavior in a positive way. So whatever you choose to do, you will be doing it, you know, well and pleasurably mm-hmm. and not hurting the other partner and thinking that that's okay.
That's just people just show. Well, that's the other thing about porn where I believe is that like they don't show the warm up.
No.
They don't show the lube. They don't show the breathing, the consent. And you're just, it goes right. Look how easily it goes in the
exactly.
anus.
Exactly. It goes in easily. There's no mess. There's no fuss. It feels good immediately. There's no pain. And that's, you know, that's what
they're seeing.
They're seeing
from
yeah.
very young ages
yeah.
in the porn, which I do believe. And people are like, do you believe in porn addiction? I'm like, I don't even need to label it, but there is a porn problem.
Right.
There is a porn challenge right now that is happening, especially
right.
if young men and young women, that's all that they're seeing with sex. How could it not impact their brain and what
and then
they're
if we are not
have
again,
sex?
If we're not having those conversations, nobody's having those conversations. You've got the sex educator right there. And mainstream media too. I mean, mainstream media is not giving them healthy messages either. And we understand that with girls. We understand that with, you know, pretty broadly, we understand now that there are a lot of harmful messages bombarding girls about women and about sex in the media. And we as, you know, parents, teachers, activists, whatever, therapists, we do a lot to help girls have a more critical lens so that they can resist some of that. We don't say anything to boys.
Nothing to boys.
Nothing.
They've learned nothing about this.
Nothing.
Right.
And then they're in the same stew, turned up hotter. And And, you know, like one guy said to me, I think music has a really big influence on how guys treat girls. Like he was a high school boy. He's like, you're driving around in the car with your guys all the time and you're hearing fuck that bitch and quitter right. 4, 5, 10 times in the space of 2 hours.
Yeah.
Of course it affects your mindset.
Of course it, there we go. Media again. That's what you're hearing. Yeah. I must fuck this bitch and quit her. If that's what it's saying, that's what I'm hearing in my head. Like that's what you do.
It just,
you don't
and,
fuck
and
that
you don't
bitch
even
and stare
know
into her eyes intimately
that it's affecting
and
you.
Cradle her face and kiss yeah. her. Take her to a nice meal. It's not saying that.
No.
It's saying quit her. Kick her out of your car.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not so, helpful.
Yeah. So that, I mean, he was just like, you know, that I see guys thinking that way,
yeah.
you know, that's the ideal. That's racking up the body count and who cares about the person and her interests, whether it's physical or emotional, are really not part of the bargain.
Not even.
You know, and a lot of guys that obviously don't do that. A lot of guys work their way through that, but there's just so much harm and misunderstanding, and
it's so much harm, and then they have to undo that
along
harm
the way.
All these
yeah.
years, like with,
yeah.
You know, whether it's drinking or sexual assault on campus. Was
yeah.
there was, I know people were really open to you about that as well in the book.
Yeah, yeah, the guys. I mean, there's a chapter called "I Know I'm a Good Guy, but .. And
that's
it's
such.
I actually wanted perfect. To call the book that for a while because I heard that so much.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, let's talk about that. I
yeah.
know, and also, I want to talk about hilarious.
Yeah,
that's good
yeah.
too.
So
yeah.
So with these, you know,
I know I'm a good guy, but this one
then,
time, or
yeah, but
my
this one
friend.
Time, or yeah, and a lot of, you know, the and so there was a lot of that was about we think only monsters commit sexual assault, and anyone who commits sexual assault or sexual misconduct is a monster,
mm-hmm.
and that blinds us, you know, and so by transitive property, then I'll try this. I'm an English major; math
yeah.
is hard on me, but I'm a good guy. Therefore, a good guy cannot commit misconduct. So whatever it was I just did could not possibly be misconduct.
Right. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, and so you...
And
so,
I'll just repress it and not think about it and it goes away.
Right, and guys, maybe. What research shows is that guys will, if... Like, they understand the definition of consent. There's this research actually out of Michigan.
Okay, great.
Where they could... articulate a very clear definition of incorrect definition of consent. But when they're then they were asked about their last hookup and their last relationship, sex and their last hookup and last relationship. And when their actions didn't meet the definition, they expanded the definition rather than questioning their actions because a good guy can't possibly have engaged in misconduct, you know, and which is probably partly why the rates of sexual assault have not changed on
yeah,
college
campuses. Yeah, I was hoping they were, but...
Yeah, no, they haven't. Not
why
yet.
Would they if
not
we
yet.
Haven't said anything to men?
Right. And this that said, I will say that the guys, what was hopeful and promising was that the guys that I was talking to were telling me about these experiences where they hadn't been good guys or where they were concerned that they hadn't been good guys. Maybe they had, maybe they hadn't, they didn't know. Were wrestling with them. And that I think 5 or 10 years ago, they wouldn't have even questioned them.
Right.
When a lot of the things they
would have asked them, it would have come up. You're
wouldn't
right.
have even come up. And it was coming up and they were thinking like, was that okay? Was that not okay? I think it might not have been okay. What do I do if it wasn't okay? So it wasn't like...
What were me meaning like they, someone was drunk or passed out or they...
Well,
they
or
were
somebody didn't
of-
say yes, but didn't say no. She just lay there.
Right.
Like, I don't know what that meant. Maybe it was fine. Maybe she was, you know, like just... interested in, you know, like wanted to see what would happen. Maybe she froze and it wasn't consensual and she's walking around feeling traumatized. Maybe, you know, this particular guy had intercourse a couple more times that was clearly consensual and then she dumped him flat. Maybe she was trying to make it okay after having a non-consensual experience. So she had 2 consensual experiences and then thought, okay, I'm done.
Right.
Maybe she just didn't like him. I don't know.
Right.
He doesn't know. So he, a year later, after this had happened, we were talking and he was, you know, we were talking, this guy was a big hookup artist guy and and he sort of stopped and said, you know, I didn't think I was going to talk about this with you, but, you know, okay, I want to talk about it. And he was wrestling with like, what should I do about that? How should I call, you know, he said, I probably should call her and find out, but you know, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And
right.
So just kind of, so that was really interesting. And then also I really struggled with how to add something to the discussion about campus sexual assault. And so what I ended up doing was a chapter on a restorative justice, process, and which is something where, there's an emphasis on healing, accountability, and justice, but not necessarily punishment. And because a lot of cases, especially on campus, especially in friend groups, let's just say it's a girl who's been harmed, she doesn't necessarily want the guy expelled or jailed or even suspended. She might, and that's fair. But if she doesn't, she just wants him to understand how he caused harm and to take, you know, to take responsibility for it and to not do it again.
Right, exactly. That's what we all want.
Right. And so this was a sort of alternative process that allowed for that. And I tell the story of two people, a guy and a girl, and it's a kind of spin on he said, she said, because I go back and forth between them as they narrate what happened and the aftermath.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And it's a really important chapter to me because it's like he just thinks he's had a bad hookup. And she's like, I was just assaulted. And she's right.
Right.
You know, but his socialization has just led him into a false assumption. And that's what I always say. It's not miscommunication. It's false assumption.
And no one's ever exactly. And it's false. What your mind allows you to interpret it because you're not telling anybody. So you're like, I don't want to think I'm a bad person.
Right.
So this is what happened. And they're not able
to
communicate
about it.
And
so he recognizes at a certain point through things happen, and he recognizes that he has done something that qualifies as assault. And he falls apart, man, because he can't imagine that he's not a monster then. And it's about, you know, how does he put himself back together, stand up, and actually be a man, you know, and take responsibility for this and move forward as a better person who will do better in the world himself and in talking to his friends and others and educating others. And he does that.
Right.
And it's the most incredible thing
to
watch.
It's such an inspiring story because you're like, this could happen. We could have this.
Yeah. There's nothing unusual about this guy. He doesn't start out in a like particularly progressive place or a particularly fun. I mean, he's like, you know, he said he grew up with like Van Wilder movies and porn and uncles who told him it's not a good night out unless you get somebody's phone number and, you know, grind non-consensually against a bunch of girls. And he was coercive with previous partners and, you know, just wanted to get to his frat, get drunk and, you know,
bang whoever's there.
Yeah, there was nothing like unusual about him.
Right.
And the fact that he could.
That's amazing.
Make this transformation.
Right. That is just.
Means that other guys could too.
It's really required reading.
Right. And it's an after the fact thing. Not ideal. But at least it's a thing.
Well, it's a thing.
At least it's an alternative.
It's something.
It created an opportunity for him to be the man that he actually did want to be. And then I think a lot of guys want to be.
That changes the whole life. No one wants to be that guy. It changes his life trajectory. No one says, I'm going to be this asshole. In their head, they're thinking,
I'm not an asshole.
No, I'm not an asshole. And I want a relationship. Yeah. Or maybe they want kids. And this is the way
they're
going
when he talks about his coercive behavior, first of all, it's a girl that he likes a lot.
Right, right. Let's talk about that.
The girl that he forces her, he holds her head down and forces her to have oral sex. And
the head
he push. Thinks, yeah, he thinks he's just. As he said, he thought he was just being a teacher and a nice guy because she wasn't very experienced.
Right.
And he really liked her. He wanted to like go out with her.
Right.
And she's like never spoke, you know, she was like out of there, you know, and going
like,
on her
I'm
own.
I'm showing you. This is what I want.
Yeah. This is how you do this. And she's just thinking, no. And so, you know, he's not sitting there thinking, I am a bad guy forcing this girl to do this, ha, 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 ha. That's not what's happening. But he has a lot of false assumptions and a lot of socialization as a guy going into that room.
But this is the thing, that he wasn't stopped early on. He had the uncles.
Right. Nobody intervened and said, this is, you know, this is what sex should be. This is what coercion is. This is what these things are. Of course, he said they had the consent thing when he started college, like the, you know, you have like
a class.
Right. Right. Like 45 minutes.
45 minute class.
And he thought, I would be the guy if I saw some guy dropping a roofie into a girl's drink who would, you know, intervene and, you know, beat that guy up and take the drink away. Like I'm
so
that
many contradictions,
good guy.
Right. But
so he would never think that he was the guy who was causing harm. And he was a lovely guy and he became a real lovely guy through this process. And again, shouldn't have come at the expense of somebody else that had to happen. But you could see that, you know, that he was very ordinary and there's nothing monstrous about him, but he just had a whole basket of bad socialization that needed to be examined and hadn't been. And if it had been, he might have been that guy before he got to that room.
And it's just, that's the thing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so well done. And it is a good example of how not being checked, never being talked about, it being filled with all this information, starting at porn at a young age, and then hearing from his uncles, his family, and then his friends reinforcing it. No one ever steps in to intervene along the way. And then he finds himself with like pushing that. That's what I've seen. She didn't want to know. This is what happened. So,
right. And he said in retrospect, he knows that's not the first time that he did something like that. He just thought that was what you did.
Yeah. Right. I think my first boyfriend did that. Now I'm here remembering that my boyfriend, but I was like 16 and I remember him like doing that. Like I like, this is how you do it. Put your head down. I was like, I don't really want to, but you know what I mean? Like, that's
right,
how
that's our socialization,
like, in the kitchen,
right?
I'm remembering. I'm like, exactly. Right?
And that's another way that the books were so much in conversation. And I talk about gay guys as being sort of a model of consent, right? Of negotiating those terms and you see that, you know, in queer spaces and kink spaces, that there's much more navigating and explicit discussion of what the parameters are of an experience. And Dan Savage, who's sex columnist.
Well, of course
you know him, right? So he talks about the four magic words that gay guys use at the start of an encounter, which are, what are you into? Which is like exactly the kind of open-ended question that, you know, as opposed to like when we put it in a heterosexual conversation, what we tend to talk about is a series of yes or no questions that a guy is asking a girl and that she's responding to. Yes, no, right? That's not it. So that's lovely and open-ended. And I worry that if a guy who was a teenager or a young adult said to a girl, what are you into? She would say, I don't know.
Well, this is the thing.
Right? But it's that's how those books are in conversation.
I know.
That's how they are talking to each other. And that's how the socialization of guys and girls works with heterosexuals.
That is such a great example.
To undermine communication and connection for everybody.
And that goes back to full circle of women, your book too. Like women, girls and sex is what... Girls don't know. Women don't know what they want. All ages, women don't know what they want. And if they do know even a little bit, they're afraid to ask for what they want because they're going to be rejected. It's going to be weird. They're not going to get it. They're going to see
Or it's going to be
slut.
A burden. Or the guy's going to feel obligated. It's going to take up too much time. It's going to, and then you feel guilt and then you can't do it. You can't feel it anyway. And
That's why I think the first lesson, and this is why I talk about day in, day out, is that the first lesson for women and for men, but especially women right now is, what do you want? What do you like?
Right.
What feels good to you? And that starts with masturbation, communicative sex, figuring out, what didn't I like about that experience?
Right.
Flip side of that, what might I like? What might work for me next time? So you can have an answer to that question. Because I remember for years, before I even started this show, I would be with guys and they'd be like, does that feel good? Do you like it? And I would just say, yeah. Everything you do is great. Because I was like, am I going to say no?
I
have nowhere to go from here. I don't know what else to do in this situation to make this better or worse. I just want it to be over. In some cases.
Right.
Many cases. Now that I look back, right? So, but even still, I feel this with so many women. They don't know what they want.
Yeah. And I would say, I mean, the stats are that only 40% of teenage girls 14 to 17 have masturbated even once. Mm.
Yeah, I know. We got it.
So 60% never have. And when I would talk to girls, when I was doing the girls and sex, they would say, well, I have a boyfriend to do that. And, you know, that's the same guy who's like rummaging around like he's looking for a set of keys in there.
Exactly.
He doesn't know what he's doing. They've never had an orgasm. And but the boys, they would never say, I'm not going to masturbate because I have a girlfriend to do that. No, they would not.
And women, I still hear my married friends, my friends, but or women I meet out. Well, no, I don't need a vibrator. I don't masturbate. I have a partner. Like this notion, in many ways, I mean, this book, that's why your books are so groundbreaking and important reads, I think, for everyone, men, women, parents, adults, children, everybody, to realize that like this is still where we're at. And there's so many more places to go right now with this conversation, but it's so important that we just educate ourselves on what we want, what actually feels good to us, which seems like, you know, I always tell you, it's fun homework. It's like a good thing. Sex is about pleasure. Can we put the fun back into sex? But no one's going to be able to teach you that. I mean, one of the things I used to think was, someday my prince will come and so will I. That was my big, like, I really believe that. He's going to ride up on this white horse and he's going to show me everything about my body, because I was certain, like, I knew nothing. And that never happened. I wasn't one of those women that just, I had an orgasm. You know, no, right. I didn't come at all until I took it into my own hands.
Well, or you are lucky if you happen as a woman to meet a partner that is collaborative and open in that way.
Yeah.
You can, you know, you're lucky and then you discover a lot, but it's kind of happenstance.
Yeah.
It's luck.
Exactly. So we're, right. And then also with these ages, why it's so interesting that to choose from 16 to 22, like they're not there yet. Many of them are not going to be there yet. So hopefully we see now people reading this book and hearing your messages that they realize like, oh yeah, it's an incentive to even start younger talking to kids, but meeting them also where they're at.
Yeah.
Because we want those adults out there. We want them to move into the world as, you know, caring, loving partners, supporters.
Egalitarian, yes. Reciprocal, all that kind of stuff. And you know, I used to say with girls all the time that I just didn't want their early experiences to be something they had to get over.
Yeah.
And I still very strongly believe that. And I don't know that guys' early experiences are, sometimes they are. Sometimes they're things they have to get over, for sure.
Yes, we hear that.
But I also don't, you know, I want their early experiences not only to be ones in which they don't cause harm, but that are actually pleasurable, reciprocal, sustaining. You know, they deserve that too.
We do, right. We all deserve it. Well, thank you so much, Peggy Orenstein, for your work, for your book. This is such an important work that you're doing, talking to them. And because I think the way you write it and the way you really are getting into their minds and the brains and their lives of kids, all diverse sector of boys in this book and girls in the other book, is such an eye opener. And I had never really read anything else like this work before. So when I first read Girls and then Boys, and I think it's a great service. And I hope it just opens up people's minds. Start talking today.
I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to my awesome team. Ken, Kristen, Elisa, Brian, our interns, producer Jamie, and Michael. Was it good for you? Email me feedback@sexwithemily.com.